most pressing issues with respect to access. And that's because, you know, most of the effective treatments are under intellectual property control by just a few corporations. And there is, you know, for the time being, at least this year, no major supply available through anyone besides those originator companies. And even that which is available through those companies is in very limited stock and purchased mostly by high-income countries. So, you know, unfortunately, we're just making the same mistakes over and over again, the same mistakes we made with vaccines and access to vaccines early on in the pandemic is the same mistake we're making with treatments right now.
Let me ask Fatima Hassan in South Africa, is the pandemic ending?
Not from where we're sitting, no.
And Mihir Mankad, with Doctors Without Borders, you have this global perspective. What do you see right now?
No, I don't think we're in a position to claim that the pandemic's ending, and you know, neither that WHO has also not indicated that the pandemic is ending anytime soon.
And finally, Fatima, what do you think would be the single most important action could be taken right now to deal with this ongoing pandemic?
So, unfortunately, because we have this weak deal, I think the single pressing thing that needs to happen is that every single country in the global south has to start issuing compulsory licenses, but not just on vaccines, also on treatments and on diagnostics, because they are ordinarily permitted to do that under the TRIPS agreement. So if we don't have strong domestic action or strong domesticating
of
the
weak
deal, we won't be able to get out of this pandemic.
Fatima Hassan, we want to thank you for being with us. Health Justice Initiative, speaking to us from South Africa. And Mihir Mankad with Doctors Without Borders, or MSF, speaking to us from New York City. And that does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Masaya Rhodes, Maria Tarasena. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Development and Events Committee meets on the fourth Monday of the month at 4:30 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
Welcome to Sojourner Truth and happy Earth Day. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Today, as we culminate Earth Week, we're bringing you a special broadcast on the environment, part three of Hoodwinked in the Hothouse. Would Build Back Better Burn Billions? This is the third panel of a series that builds on the momentum created by the most recent report, Hoodwinked in the Hothouse, third edition, Resist False Solutions to Climate Change. As part of President Biden's infrastructure plan, federal and state governments are providing billions of dollars in so-named climate subsidies, policy incentives and tax breaks to dangerous and dirty energy industries. These include biomass and waste incinerators, nuclear power, and carbon capture and storage infrastructure for fossil fuel facilities. As a result, frontline communities will be facing increased pollution burdens and toxic threats. Today's panel highlights emergent threats of climate fault solutions across the United States, federal, and state policy landscapes. Panelists are community campaigners, community leaders, researchers, and frontline organizations who are fighting the myths associated with carbon capture and storage, nuclear, hydrogen, biofuels, and waste incineration, along with debunking what they see as false climate crisis solutions. They also highlight inspiring stories of success led by environmental justice communities. They point out that to effectively move money away from dangerous policy directions and towards real climate justice solutions, coalition building is needed amongst national green groups, labor unions, climate philanthropy, and policy makers who should work with frontline communities in opposing these schemes. This panel was preceded by Hoodwinked in the Hot House Part 1, examining false corporate schemes being advanced through the Paris Agreement, and by Hoodwinked in the Hot House Part 2, Frontline Voices of Indigenous Resistance Beyond Climate False Solutions. If you have missed Parts 1 and 2, you can find them on the Sojourner Truth link on SoundCloud. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Christina Onnested. The Senate has advanced a gun control measure. The move was late Tuesday. A full vote could occur this week, Nadia Romligon reports.
Bipartisan gun bill includes enhanced background checks for those younger than 21, funding for mental health and school safety, incentives for states to implement red flag laws, and limits on the boyfriend loophole. Democratic Connecticut Senator Chris Murphy.
This is a breakthrough, and more importantly, it's a bipartisan breakthrough.
I'm Nadia Ramlagan for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
It comes amidst pleas to do something in the wake of deadly mass shootings in Buffalo, New York, and Uvalde, Texas. The botched police response to the mass shooting at the Robb Elementary School in Uvalde was the subject of a Texas Senate hearing Tuesday, where the head of the state police said law enforcement had enough officers on the scene to stop the gunman 3 minutes after he entered the school, but it took them nearly an hour to respond. Villette Bilou reports.
There's compelling evidence that the law enforcement response to the attack at Robb Elementary was an abject failure.
Texas State Police Colonel Steve McGraw said officers arrived in the hallway 58 minutes before breaching the door where the gunman was holed up with children. McGraw confirmed that officers heard gunshots 3 times as they waited for orders to go in. The officers were heavily armed with assault-type weapons and even a large shield. That's contrary to officials' accounts that the officers were armed only with pistols and had to wait for reinforcements. This contradicts the common Republican narrative that the way to stop a bad person with a gun is a, quote, good person with a gun. Several Democrats urged Texas to adopt safety measures to help prevent gun violence. Roland Gutierrez represents Uvalde.
We do have to find common sense gun solutions. When 65% of the Republicans in my community tell me that we need to raise an age limit, I can tell you that an 18-year-old shouldn't be able to go into a store like he's going into a 7-Eleven to buy a Slurpee. And that's what happened here.
I'm Violette Bilou, Pacifica Radio, KPFA.
The House committee investigating the deadly January 6th Capitol attack held its fourth hearing Tuesday. The focus was then President Donald Trump's pressure campaign on state officials and local election workers to overturn the results of the election he lost, with plans that include fake electors. Christopher Martinez reports.
The committee focused on what it describes as Trump's pressure campaign on officials in key swing states, beginning with Election Day attempts to stop the count of mail-in ballots, then urging state legislatures and governors to stop certifying results, then a pressure campaign on state legislatures to certify fake electors supporting Trump, none of which worked. The committee's investigative counsel, Casey Lussier, walked through an account of attempts to count fake electors for Trump, including one involving a Republican Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin.
A staffer for Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson texted a staffer for Vice President Pence just minutes before the beginning of the joint session. This staffer stated that Senator Johnson wished to hand deliver to the Vice President the fake electors' votes from Michigan and Wisconsin. The Vice President's aide unambiguously instructed them not to deliver the fake votes to the Vice President.
Several election officials told about being the subject of things like mass email and phone campaigns. Shay Moss and her mother, Ruby Freeman, work in the Department of Elections and Registrations in Fulton County, Georgia. Trump blasted both women, calling Freeman a professional vote scammer and hustler. Later, Moss and her mother were harassed by angry Trump supporters, including death threats. Ruby Freeman gave a video interview to the committee.
There is nowhere I feel safe. Nowhere. Do you know how it feels to have the President of the United States to target you? He targeted me, Lady Ruby, who stand up to help Fulton County run an election in the middle of the pandemic.
The next episode of the January 6th hearings is scheduled for Thursday, when the committee will look at what Chair Thompson describes as Trump efforts to corrupt the Department of Justice. Reporting for Pacifica Radio News KPFA, I'm Christopher Martinez.
Afghanistan state-run news agency says an earthquake in the country's east has killed 1,000 people and injured 1,500 others. The latest figure came from the Bakhtar news agency today. Rescue efforts are likely to be complicated since many international aid agencies have left Afghanistan after the Taliban took over the country last year. In Ukraine, the press freedom group Reporters Without Borders says it believes a Ukrainian photojournalist and a soldier who was accompanying him were coldly executed in Russian-occupied woodlands in the first week of the war in Ukraine. Reporters Without Borders said they found 14 bullet holes in a burned hulk of the dead man's car and items apparently left behind by Russian soldiers. Reporters Without Borders released its findings today and says it's turned over evidence to Ukrainian investigators. In the U.S., President Joe Biden is expected to call on Congress to suspend the federal gas tax for 3 months today. It's expected to ease financial pressures at the pump this election year. Administration officials say Biden wants to suspend the 18-cent a gallon tax on gas and the 24-cent a gallon tax on diesel fuel. Savings could be passed along to consumers at about 3% at the pump. The president visited a vaccination clinic in Washington Tuesday where some of the first shots were given to young children. Starting this week, the nation's youngest ages 6 months to 5 years can now receive a COVID-19 vaccine from Pfizer or Moderna. Child COVID vaccinations are low. Some 30% of children have been vaccinated, while 78% of the overall U.S. population is vaccinated. Biden says more funds are needed to help brace for the next coming COVID-19 surge this fall. I'm Christina Onnestad reporting for Pacifica Radio.
Those were our news headlines. We will now go to Hoodwinked in the Hot House, Part 3, Would Build Back Better Burn Billions?
Tom, thank you for joining us. I wondered if you would share some opening reflections on the relevance of Hoodwinked and this examination of corporate false solutions today.
From our Indigenous Environmental Network and standing with the analysis from the South, we say that the result of this UN Paris Agreement is that it's a trade agreement. It's nothing more. It's not a climate agreement. It's a trade agreement. It promises to privatize, to commodify, and to sell forested lands as carbon offsets, proving a financial laundering mechanism for rich developed countries and the corporations, the polluting corporations of the North, to launder their carbon pollution on the backs of the global South and in the North on the backs of our Indigenous, Black, and people of color and low-income communities. But it's surprising that a lot of the general society, the public in the North, Canada, United States, and civil society throughout the world haven't put that together. That's why it was very important for us to come together and to produce the third version of this Hoodwinked in the Hot House publication with the goal to demystify carbon markets, carbon pricing, geoengineering technologies, extreme energy developments, such as mega hydro dams, for an example, nuclear energy. And there's a lot of other forms of energy that's being proposed that is not clean and it's destructive. We've seen a dangerous slide since our participation, since I've been going into the hallways of these UN climate meetings. It's a slide towards a lawless capitalism. I like to say it isn't. but it's where this free market ideology, neoliberalism, is privatizing every aspect of our lives, and virtually there's no public oversight to this, no accountability of their profiteering. That's how serious this issue is, and why we found as Indigenous peoples that we need to wake up the world. Somehow the world has lost that relationship to the sacredness of Mother Earth and Father Sky, and that we feel that Mother Earth is not for sale. The sky is not for sale. So part of the politics around climate change that we're seeing here domestically in the United States, including our sisters to have to deal with the same politics in Canada and throughout the world, is a politics of desperation. And we see that not only within the environmental and climate movements, the non-governmental organizations, but also politicians and the foundations and funders. And it's just that in a lot of this work, we have used the word disaster capitalism, tied with the short-sightedness of carbon and techno-fundamentalism that's driving this corporate false promises. Even the flooding of big money from philanthropists such as Bill Gates, Jeff Bezos, and Elon Musk, who are pushing false solutions, especially within geoengineering technologies such as carbon capture and storage and solar radiation management. Our concern, for an example, with these funders, they sourced up to a tune of $100 million some of the major NGOs that are fighting us when we speak the truth on how these false solutions do not cut admissions at the source that we need. So we ask you to download, to get a copy of Hoodwinked, and you'll see a whole package of exposures of this climate investment schemes. And it is like Ananda said, it's designed to reward the profiteers, who are the very folks that are causing the problem and the pollution. Mm-hmm. And for any of our folks that want to participate in these systems, I ask the question, how do you reconcile participation in these false solutions that commodify and privatizes Mother Earth and nature? We've started to work on one area way back in the early 2000s on reducing emissions from deforestation and degradation. It was a carbon offset initiative that still is continuing, called RED. For an example, Chevron or Shell, who pollute in California, they can offset their pollution locally by going carbon neutral, buying carbon credits to protect the trees in the Amazon. Carbon sponges as scams that really allow the polluters to continue to pollute in the north, creating toxic hotspots. That's wrong. So now we're seeing a rebranding of the organizing that we did with many different organizations throughout the world to expose like RED as being a scam. They rebranded it. Now it's called Nature-Based Solutions, Nature-Based Solutions. And my other final comment on these is that we have to really be educated on everything that's happening, as people from the US, people from different countries, civil society that still is having a hard time getting into the COP. That's a big concern as well. We're very cautious on Green New Deal governmental initiatives as being part of green economy scams, and using terms such as regenerative agriculture. Check these out, where they're using soil now and the carbon in the soil, but whose money is that? That money comes from the polluters again as an offset for their pollution. And this worldview, how the world uses machines to make meaning of life, where Mother Earth is objectified like the objectification of woman and treated like a machine made of parts that can be replaced, redesigned, or engineered. That's really where we're at in this world, where DNA is coded to be edited and deleted at the whims of the corporations, where our bodies and engines and food is fuel, where the world is not seen as the complex, interdependent, beautiful, and sacred relations. Mitakie Owase. We are all related. The publication is very timely. The world is being promised that these fault solutions addressing climate change will eradicate poverty and world hunger, empower our women, address environmental justice issues, and provide funding for just transition and help Indigenous peoples obtain land rights and guarantee our right to free, prior, informed consent. This is not happening. This is a lie. It's a collection of conflicts, contradictions, and lies. Mother Earth is the source of life, which needs to be protected. We only have one Mother Earth. Let's protect her. Thank you very much.
Jackie Patterson of the Chisholm Legacy Project. Many of you know her formerly as the director of the NAACP's Environmental and Climate Justice Program. Can you share your reflections on this moment and why we need to really be wary of these false solutions and even tackle them?
Speaking of kind of language and framing and analysis, one thing I really appreciated about the Hoodwinked and the Hot House is the way it uncovers how people are using language and ways to shroud what the actual goal is. And as you say, working with frontline communities, it's been a constant battle to keep in front of and help to dismantle the false narratives that are being put across with these false solutions. I mean, things like nature-based solutions. Who doesn't want nature-based solutions, you know? And so it sounds so awesome, you know? It sounds like you're talking about biomimicry. It sounds like you're talking about leaning into the natural systems of our ecosystem. As Tom said, you look under the hood and you see what's actually being done there. And so, especially with the number of the communities with whom I'm working who are new to the climate space, they feel like they're excited because they're doing work on climate or environmental justice in a different way. And then people come in and they're using this kind of language and they think, this is what I'm doing too. I'm doing this environmental thing. And they're talking about nature-based solutions. Then you have to kind of run behind like the Grim Reaper and say, you know, actually that's not, you know, and there's this constant need to vigilantly help to unpack false narratives and this false notion of even what equity is in the context of solutions.
Thanks, Jackie. Next, I'll introduce my friend Ariel. Ariel Derange, the director of Indigenous Climate Action.
Thank you so much for having me as a part of this panel discussion. As Tom so eloquently put, they have really inundated the spaces in which state or colonial leaders are really trying to drive climate solutions. So I'm really glad that this conversation is finally coming to a forefront that is actually has like momentum built around it, that we're now seeing this really broad sector of intersectional movements from you know, women's groups to Black liberation groups to the Villa Campesinas to the Pacific Islanders to all of the different struggles that have been rooted in justice for our people. And justice comes in so many different forms, whether it's like land justice for reparations, whether it's land justice for our communities for getting our land back in North America or Turtle Island, whether it's the movements of fighting against the deeply, deeply entrenched racial discrimination and racism and white supremacy that exists throughout the Americas. We are at this forefront where the climate justice has intersected with everything. And when we talk about justice, we really need to look at what a climate justice framework is. So we were asked, and it kind of didn't happen, but I'm going to read the paragraph because I think this is an important context. So this is in the introduction to Hoodwinked in the Hot House. A climate justice framework does not reduce the climate crisis to a puzzle simply focused on counting carbon. Grassroots, community-led movements around the world look across the economy at the exploitation of land, labor and living systems, at the erosion of seed, soil, story, and spirit, and seek to lift up real solutions around us every day, from indigenous traditional knowledge, food sovereignty, decommodification of land, healthcare and housing, to abolishing the military-industrial complex seeking to extract the last dredge of fossil fuel from Mother Earth. From just transition and energy democracy, where democratized, decentralized, detoxified, and decarbonized energy powers our lives, to transformative justice, where we respond to the violence and trauma with compassion and healing, not policing, punishment, and prisons. I think that when we talk about that and you read that definition of what a climate justice framework looks like, and again, this is in the introduction to the Hoodwinked in the Hot House report, you start to understand that the solutions that are being put forward by colonial governments, whether in the US or so-called Canada or in any of the colonial countries, which is basically all of them at this point, let's be real, that these systems are not holding those at the values. We heard on the historical context that when we talked about early agreements for climate, for addressing the climate crisis in the Kyoto Accord, for example, it reframed. We talked about all of this stuff at the Rio Summit in 1992 about the fact that we need to be talking about seeds and soil and people and humanity and, you know, coming back into relationship with each other and with the land. And that was distorted and skewed into having a conversation that relegated the climate crisis to an economic discussion. And what we're seeing now being driven across the Americas and across the world, false solutions that uphold and support an economy and a system that does little to actually reduce the emissions while safeguarding economic systems, including big corporations and big governments are in bed with these corporations to continue to railroad communities, marginalized folks, indigenous peoples, Black communities, and all of the other folks that have been, you know, disempowered and disenfranchised from these systems from the very beginning. So far, you know, there's a lot of these conversations, and as Tom said, we're seeing this repackaging. We're seeing this appropriation, really, of indigenous ideologies that we have been fighting for and advocating for within these structures to push back against these economic structures, to say that we need to be listening to nature. We've talked about natural law. We've talked about our relationships with Mother Earth. And those have been, again, once again, appropriated, repackaged, and recommodified as nature-based solutions, carbon offsets, blue carbon, all of these different structures that do nothing but continue to commodify the natural world and allow big polluters to keep polluting and allow those that are in power to stay in power and do very little to address the justice frameworks that I just spoke about at the beginning. We need to be looking at ways to recenter ourselves, our relationships, and separate ourselves from this economic structure and remove it out of the conversation. If we are going to address the climate crisis, we cannot do it from an economic perspective. And one of the things that Indigenous Climate Action has been doing over the last couple of years is we've really been looking at how we can begin to unpack what decolonizing climate policy can look like. And so we recently released a report that looked at Canadian climate policy, and it's called Decolonizing Climate Policy in Canada. And it investigated the shortcomings and problems associated with Canadian climate policy while at the same time supporting and developing Indigenous-led climate policy. Climate policies by and for Indigenous people that will raise up and empower Indigenous-led solutions. And this is so important because we have to be looking at deconstructing and the undoing of current systems to create space for our own independent processes and plans that are built around this holistic, interconnected, balanced approach that's based on relationship, reciprocity, and respect for each other and the natural world. And so within that context, like within Canada, you know, we're often looked at as this you know, sort of nice country by a lot of folks. But the reality is these same solutions that are being driven forward that we hear about by, you know, the big ugly country, the USA, we're doing the same thing here in Canada, except we package it really, really nicely. With Indigenous peoples and the Indigenous peoples within Canada, the government is parading things around like Indigenous protected and conservation areas as a way to broach both truth and reconciliation by allowing Indigenous peoples to have the ability to manage conservation zones. But those conservation zones are being underwritten by big corporations, Shell, Exxon, Suncor, Syncor. Some of the biggest operators in the tar sands are underwriting these conservation offset programs that they're then going to be using once we have developed a mitigation strategy that they're hoping for that can be utilized not just within Canada as a way to offset their emissions, but within the international systems that are being negotiated at the UN level. And so we have to be very careful about when colonial governments give us or hand us a so-called olive branch as marginalized communities, as disenfranchised communities where the systems were never created for us or by us or with us, that when they hand these opportunities for us, what is the hidden agenda? We have to constantly be thinking about what is the hidden agenda behind government suddenly just very like, oh, we want you to manage your lands and territories because it benefits them and it creates the optics that they're doing something. But at the end of the day, the colonial governments still determine which areas become conservation offsets. They would never give the conservation offsets to the Wet'suwet'en clans that have been fighting for the protection of their homelands, even though it is a rich, biodiverse region that deserves just as much conservation and protection as other areas that have been listed in this country. But because it has already been, titled to a corporation for exploitation, it does not get it. So they're only giving what they feel is going to benefit them, the corporations, and the entire system of false solutions to be pushed forward that continues to railroad and marginalize our communities. So we have to move forward and support each other. We have to support each other in this movement for liberation from false solutions and liberation from capitalism, liberation from white supremacy.
Last but not least, I'd love to introduce our sister and comrade, Monyeka de Oro, of the Micronesia Climate Change Alliance.
Hi, everybody. I'm so honored to be here. I come from Micronesia and 2 million square miles of homelands and seas for under 1 million people. So it's not really well known. I live in the islands of the Marianas, which is made up of Guam and the Commonwealth of the Northern Marianas. And most of the islands are affiliated through compact agreements with the United States, or in my case of the islands of the Marianas, as territories or modern day colonies, because our experiences with climate change are so dire. So people from the Pacific are on the front lines of climate change. We are at risk of experiencing more storms, and the intensity of the storms have been increasingly hard. I'm on the island of Saipan right now. Just a few years ago, they were hit by the biggest storm in over 100 years. Within 100 years, there's the absolute threat that these lands may be gone forever. And of course, the ocean is so important. It's the source of life for us in the Pacific. All water is a source of life. The people in the Pacific contribute very little to this crisis. We don't emit very much carbons. We don't use very much. And it's really unfortunate that our voices aren't very, very much listened to or heard at these international talks. And especially my people, because we're territories of the United States, we aren't invited to even regional talks in the Pacific about our mitigation plans or adaptation plans to climate change, and definitely not in any sort of way that would bring justice to my communities. I was just in a Pacific Climate Justice Summit a month ago, and there was panels speaking about the benefits of nature-based solutions. And I'm not too sure about the framework of what happens out here in the Pacific and if there's a disconnect between communities based on language barriers and just distance. But nature-based solutions are very much being touted as climate solutions in the Pacific. Most places that do have nature-based solution programs or REDD Plus programs are in places where the indigenous communities are very much oppressed. These are places like Papua New Guinea and the Solomon Islands and Vanuatu and Fiji, where there is definitely a language barrier between them and the United Nations partners or other partners where these programs are being implemented. So there's definitely a need in the Pacific to connect to more people like the Indigenous Environmental Network. One of the biggest things that faced my community, especially throughout Micronesia, is just our relationship and our historical issues regarding colonization and militarization of our lands. Because we are between Asia and between the US, we are often used as pawns between the world superpowers. And here you see some photos of nuclear bomb testings in the Marshall Islands. And then of course, World War II ravaged and completely damaged most of our homelands throughout the islands. And war is still being heavily pushed as economic solutions in our communities. I come from Guam, and a third of our island is used for military use. And right now, the US is creating firing ranges over our single sole source of drinking water. And these firing ranges will undoubtedly lead to lead contamination of this water. And these are over sacred sites. They're demolishing ancestral sites that were used for thousands of years by my ancestors without any free, informed, and prior consent. And for the United Nations to not recognize the emissions of the military entities across the world is a great travesty to this climate justice movement. War is really fueling the warming of our world. It's really important to hold these entities accountable. The US military is the single largest consumer of fossil fuels. All the fossil fuels that are being pushed through the pipelines that are being resisted throughout Turtle Island are coming to my islands so that they could be fueling jet fuels and bombing pristine islands just north of here, in Fernando Mendoza here. All of these things are interconnected, and it's really important that we do what we can to bring peace to our communities, real peace and real genuine security through doing the things of principled practice, through realizing the just transition, and through being and uplifting the indigenous people around the world. By the government not seeing that at the United Nations Conference of Parties is really disheartening to me as a young organizer.
In the belly of the beast, how are we going to fight some of these policy pathways?
Through these kind of surface solutions, we're going to continue to have the same problems because we're not getting to the root causes, which we know are kind of these systems of exploitation, domination, extraction, and so forth. And so one is pointing that out, but two is actually demonstrating the changes that we need to see in the world and really uplifting that this is these are the solutions. So starting to not waiting for policies, pushing for the policies, but at the same time actually beginning to implement the changes we need to see in the world. We're already seeing, you know, local food movements. We're already seeing people starting to treasure the land, treasure and having a new relationship with the earth and the earth systems, and really recognizing that in how we interact with the earth and how we interact with each other, the rules of the land, like the rules of our ecosystem, the not just the rules, but practices and principles of our natural ecosystems are really modeling for us how we need to be. So if we start to do that and start to advance this narrative around biomimicry and so forth, then we start to really model the change that we need to see in the world. And so as we see folks who are growing their own food, folks who are generating their own energy, folks who are living in deep relationship with the land, and as we lift up those narratives and show that this is the sustainable, this is the true solutions to the not only the climate crisis, but to the other crises that we talk about with the syndemic. And as we think about our economy and having a living economy where all are valued, then we start to see the types of true systems change that we need. So first is you know, pointing out the error of their ways, pointing out the true path, but then again, that whole kind of adage of show, don't tell.
I think that the reality is that I've heard over and over and over again from a lot of the sort of traditional environmental movement folks and organizations and movements that getting something is better than getting nothing as a justification for their moving and backing and supporting false solutions or solutions that further undermine or subjugate, marginalize, disempower people of color. And I think that it's easy for them to justify that because they come from a very privileged place. They come from a place where their organizations are founded on ideologies of white environmentalism, that the environment is something to be protected for the elite. It's like the environmental movement really sort of stems from the national parks paradigm, the protecting nature for the enjoyment of the elite. And so when we talk about the climate crisis, I really feel like a lot of these old ENGOs, like old school white ENGOs, come from that very centered point that the climate needs to be saved for the elite, that it is a place for those that are contributing to society under a colonial white supremacist framework are the society that the world is being saved for. So of course it's easy to justify the continuation of, you know, extractivism in Indigenous communities, of the exploitation of labor, of the continuation of status quo within a capitalist, a predatory capitalist society that we live in. And so some of the tactics and strategies are not just focusing on interrupting the colonial state. Like, we have to also interrupt people that have been our allies, because in many cases in the past decade, our allies have utilized our stories through tokenistic and appropriating processes that have done little to actually build up our communities, to build a movement of people of color. Rather, they're utilizing our stories to help justify their power as the people that are making the decisions. And I've seen this very well, where a lot of well-intentioned, I don't want to say these people are malicious in their intent, well-intentioned white NGOs are sucking up a lot of the airspace in these places, and they have positioned themselves over the years as the experts, that their modalities and methodologies for collecting data, my birds are very excited about this conversation, are the way to move forward. And that we have to accept that that's what's going to move forward. When in reality, we also have, we're on double duty as people of color. We're constantly not just pushing back colonial systems. We also have to push back against our allies to see how these very structures are also marginalizing and continuing to oppress us. And that means stepping in. When they say, oh, we're looking for a new Indigenous like researcher to join our team, say, why? Why are you joining that? You know, we're hiring all these people of color to help us build our programs. Is that really your job? Is that really your place? Because you know what would be better? Don't take that resource and that grant to hire a person of color. Give that to a people of color organization, you know, Black, Indigenous people of color organization, to let them do it for themselves. That is actually upholding self-determination, sovereignty, free, prior, and informed consent, not sucking up all the air and asking us to join their movement. So when we talk about this, we absolutely have to be calling out, and this is an uncomfortable conversation to call out our allies, but we aren't going to win the movement without them either. We have to have them on our side, and if that means we need to have hard, uncomfortable conversations with our allies, and you need to be willing to get uncomfortable. You need to be willing to feel a little bit like agitated, and you have to ask yourself why. Because if we continue to allow these organizations to push false solutions, it continues to undermine our strength as Indigenous, Black, people of color movements to push forward our agendas for self-determined, community-oriented, grassroots-led solutions that support justice frameworks for us to be free from the clutches of colonial capitalist systems that have oppressed our people for generations.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. We're going to take a short station break. When we return, we'll hear more from Hoodwink in the Hot House Part 3, Would Build Back Better Burn Billions? Thank you. Okay, welcome back to Sojourner Truth. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. Check out our website at sotrueradio.org. If you're a member of Facebook, you can like and friend us there. We're also nationwide and internationally on SoundCloud. And today we'd like to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in the state of Mississippi. That is Mississippi. And internationally, we would like to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners throughout the Caribbean region. By the way, our handle on Instagram and Twitter at SoTrueRadio. We're now going to return to the last speaker of part three of Hoodwinked in the Hothouse.
Monica, you've had some dealings with folks advancing blue carbon offsets and other things. Do you have any thoughts on what it is?
One conversation that has been a recurring conversation in the climate justice space is what to do about the Bezos Fund. You know, he donated $10 billion to different environmental fronts, and most of them were big greens who don't share our principled practices when it comes to the climate crisis. And it's such an interesting space to be a part of climate justice, and where we really want to, like, question how was it that Bezos was able to increase his wealth during a pandemic? How was it that we have these systems that these rich elite people are feeling good about themselves for creating the problem and then just throwing money to make it seem like they're doing something about it? And it's really important that we continue to ask those questions, put pressure on these allies or not, to invest in green grassroots frontline organizing and to really build power and take power away from those structures that have harmed our communities and continuously destroy our environment. And it's so simple, but it's so difficult given all the different political divisions in our communities today across the states, across the world. It's really that marketing scheme that Tom and both Ariel and Jackie has spoken to is really important to unravel and understand. And again, that's why I think Hoodwinked is such a perfect resource for anyone coming into this climate justice movement to really grasp the gravity of ways in which we need to be moving forward and ways in which we need to be resisting these false solutions. And yeah, out here in the Pacific, the blue carbon credits and ocean policies are really being pushed in the States and also here. And it's really, there's not enough being done to counter that. And I just am grateful for this space for really pushing me and encouraging me to look further into those things happening here in my own backyard.
Even some of the best formulated strategies that try to be holistic, when they lack the participation, the democratic participation, the vision and leadership of frontline communities, they lack, you know, a really clear guidance on how to avoid all the pitfalls of, you know, market-based mechanisms, neoliberal policies. And oftentimes, like drawdown, or, you know, when I first looked at the drawdown framework, it was very clearly, I mean, though it tried to be holistic, its fundamental problem was that it put on the same footing problematic solutions like nuclear power and mega hydro alongside real, sort of agrarian small community led solutions. And we can't have that. They can't be on the same footing. When we talk about climate justice, we really talk about flipping the script, because unless we take a radical departure from the status quo, recognize that we can't afford to build back better. We can't afford to go back to the status quo and recreating what was. We need to depart from these systems of exploitation and destruction and start forging new ones. Well, in that conversation, I mean, like, it's one of the things that's clear is that we need to center the voices of frontline communities, but that itself is a difficult proposition. I don't know, alongside pushing hard on these political allies, do our panelists, Jackie, do you have any thoughts on where, because you're someone who I find is very compelling in very soft and gentle, but very, clear ways. And what are some of your experiences of working in some of these worlds and trying to shift funding towards the front lines? And what gets us to change the perspectives and worldviews of some of our big green allies, if you will?
And one of the things that we talk about is a need to make sure that we're able to caucus within, we can push for with these organizations when they start to feel threatened, when BIPOC folks start coming together, frontline folks start coming together, and they subtly try to push back against that, is making sure that we push forward on that and make sure that that happens, because we not only build power together, but we also support each other against that kind of chafing of constantly being chafed against the system that doesn't share a similar analysis and view. So that's one thing. Two is when I've been talking to some of these folks often, it's really kind of getting people to be clear on outcomes and strategy. Because a lot of times people will say that this is what they want, and then having to really break it down and say, okay, yeah, you know, we want maybe similar things, but the path to get there, here's where we differ. And that's what some of the conversations I've been having, even with some of these major money movers, it's been really around that, and having to really point out that it's really only through grassroots action and grassroots leadership that what you're claiming you want is actually going to happen. So either you don't actually want what you're saying you want, so that's really the challenge that I'm finding, that I'm constantly having to put forward, is to say, like, if you really actually are saying that you want to have the society that actually, you know, is turning back the tide of climate change, then this is the only way that it's going to get there. What you're saying is actually not going to work. And here's what is going to work. And here are the examples of where it actually already has worked. And so that's what I find myself kind of constantly doing. And this is why often when you see the different things that I write, it always ends with like a whole long list of the people that are already doing what we need to have done. Whether it's and it goes back to what I said in the very beginning, that it's all about kind of showing that we already have the solutions, that the solutions are already in motion, and what we need is for other people to really just get behind and get on board. And so that's the kind of what I'm constantly hammering home, which has mixed success, that's the method, as you say, just kind of continuing to put it in front of people.
Monika, do you have any closing thoughts, reflections?
I definitely do want to again call and uplift the struggles of my people to demilitarize and decolonize. I'm part of the Chamorro Nation out here in the Marianas, and we have been U.S. territory since 1898 and post-World War II, even more so. And I think really just driving home that piece that we really need to, leading up to COP, we really do need to ensure that internationally we hold military institutions to the protocols, and that we should stop exempting the military, especially the U.S. military, who's the largest consumer of fossil fuels, single largest producer of pollutants on the planet, as well as the protector of the fossil fuel industry, and just drive that fact home. And also just wanted, it's a full moon, it's a full moon now, and I think it's also really important for everyone to reattune themselves back out to nature, to really take time and space to take care of themselves. It's a really distressing time in our world today, and any moments that you can find to be mindful, to be present, and to be conscious of our interconnectedness is also a big part of how we need to be showing up in this climate movement, and how we need to be accountable to our own personal health, because really this movement is so demanding of us, mind, body, spirit, and it's so important that we do the work that we need to do to take care of ourselves and our communities, and be holistic in our approach of self-care and our approach of really trying to build new systems and a new way of being.
Jackie, would you like to share some closing reflections?
Sure, thank you. Yes, after Monika's beautiful sharing, this is going to seem hyper tactical, but in the U.S., I feel like we need to get money out of politics. The undue influence of the fossil fuel industry and these other industries is just, egregiously damaging here. And we really need all movements to get behind getting money out of politics if we really want to have forward motion from a legislative standpoint.
Thanks, Jackie.
I'm gonna echo Jackie on that. It's not even just out of politics. We need to get all of our public dollars, all of our personal dollars out of the fossil fuel industry, There is a growing divestment movement, and we need that divestment movement also to be challenged to have it being community-led. Because if we talk divestment, what is reinvestment? And if our community's initiatives and solutions are not valued or held up at an equal platform and in an equal position, then we're going to see reinvestments being led by the same corporations that have led the tragedy of the climate crisis that we're in. We'll just see Exxon building massive solar farms. And so we have to talk about divestment, divestment of oil and gas out of our politics, divestment out of our dollars into the bank systems, into insurance, into our pension funds, divestment across the board. But that divestment needs to be led by community. And so bottom line, we need to be talking about decolonizing structures. We need to be building up our communities, building our power back in our communities to be seen, to be validated by ourselves. We don't need white validation. We need validation by ourselves, because years of colonization has made it so hard that when we see the validation from our own communities, we don't always hear it. But we need to empower our communities that we say, I see you, you are powerful, you are beautiful, you have the solutions right there. And then when we empower our communities, when we talk about divestment and reinvestment, all those beautiful solutions, and I've seen it in the chat, Black women are already building solutions, femmes are building solutions, Indigenous people are building solutions. Like, these solutions are everywhere. It's about valuing them, holding them up, deeply investing in them, and changing the narrative away from this economic-based structure of addressing the climate crisis. That will require us to decolonize our minds, decolonize our processes, and move forward together, unified in the struggle to address the climate crisis, not from a carbon accounting way, but from a holistic approach that brings us all, that asks us all to do what Onyeka said, put our feet in the soil, be connected, be together as one. And that's going to take a lot of undoing, but I really believe we can do it. And we can't take those shortcuts. We can't just say something is better than nothing. We have to demand better, and we have to do it now.
Thank you so much, everyone. That was really, really so enlightening and powerful. If you can, just put your hands over your heart so we can all, like Ariel said, try to be one. Take a nice deep breath. And I'm going to lead us out with the chant called Unuhit, which is just a reminder and a prayer that we are all one and we are all connected. Unuhit zanitanu itasi atal zanilange. We are one with the earth, with the sky, with the sun, with the sea, we are one.
We're out of time. Today's show edited by Sojourner Truth, assistant producer Alicia Vargas. We thank her for her work, and we'd also like to thank today's board op. Sojourner Truth will be back on the air. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Stay well and safe, and I hope you get to do something really nice this weekend. Thank you for listening.